This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, it is now official. Xi Jinping is the all-powerful leader of the People's Republic of China. Hello again, I'm Carol Castillo. President Xi Jinping secured an unprecedented third term as leader of the ruling Communist Party. After the recently concluded 20th Party Congress, analysts say Xi is in a position to rule for another decade, if not for life. Casting off party custom under which his predecessors left after 10 years in power, Xi Jinping is cementing his place as the most powerful Chinese ruler since Mao Zedong. The party also named a 7-member standing committee for a 5-year term, which is dominated by Xi allies. Several new standing committee members lack national-level experience, normally a prerequisite for the post, illustrating that the leadership lineup prizes loyalty over ability. Xi's remarks underscored his goal of making China a modern socialist power by 2035, meaning raising per capita income to middle-class levels and modernizing the armed forces. On the 100th anniversary of the People's Republic of China, so by 2049, he wants to ensure the nation, quote, leads the world in terms of composite national strength and international influence, unquote. In a defiant tone, Xi Jinping reported that he would double down on the unpopular zero COVID policies and call for resistance to foreign powers bent on containing Beijing and undermining a peaceful world order, a thinly veiled reference to the United States and its defense alliances in Europe and Asia. On the topic of Taiwan, The Economist David Rennie said Xi's report contained, quote, a mix of blandishments and threats to use force if that democratic island declares independence, but no new urgent deadlines for its conquest, unquote. Well, joining us to discuss the major takeaways from the 20th Party Congress and what the results mean for China's domestic and foreign policy, we turn to two China watchers. David Shulman is senior director of the Global China Hub at the Atlantic Council, a prominent think tank in Washington. Prior to joining the council, David served for more than 10 years as the U.S. government's top expert on East Asia, most recently on the National Intelligence Council. And Carla Freeman, she is a senior expert on China at the U.S. Institute of Peace. That's a nonpartisan, congressionally funded agency based in Washington. Prior to joining USIP, Carla Freeman was a member of the China Studies faculty at Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. And both panelists joined me via Microsoft Teams. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Carol.
Thank you.
Well, David Shulman, let me begin with you. What are your main takeaways from the Party Congress? Did anything take you by surprise?
Well, I think that's the perfect question, because as you laid out in that introduction there, obviously we know that Xi Jinping was able to, as everyone's saying, run the table at this Congress in a personnel sense. And so I think even though most observers of China expected that Xi Jinping was going to come out of this Party Congress with a third term as General Secretary and fundamentally deepening his level of power and control within the Chinese system, I think this level of movements at the top in terms of who he put on the Politburo Standing Committee, who was removed, and who did not even make it to the Politburo level was fairly striking. But I think at the same time, it's also notable that there were no real surprises in terms of the comments that Xi made in his traditional work report at the outset of the Party Congress. What we get out of that report is a sense of continuity in terms of Xi's policies and what he's going to do with this even increased level of power. And that's unfortunate, because that means that what we're going to see out of China going forward is even more of his repressive policies at home, even more aggression abroad. And you mentioned this, Carol, in the outset, but the dark vision that Xi paints in the work report about China's external security environment is really striking. It's a China that's surrounded by threats everywhere it looks, that there's an unnamed particular power, the United States, that is really fundamentally threatening China's interests. And this notion of a threat to China's security, and that word security is throughout the speech, is really notable. And the fact that there is not the kind of reference to reform or any nod towards the need to carry through with a more liberalized economic policy really gives us a sense that these statist policies that we've had in the economic domain are going to continue. And as you said, that there's no reason to believe that the zero COVID policy is going to be lifted anytime soon, which, of course, along with those stated policies, has had a really dampening effect on China's economic growth thus far and probably will continue. It's both surprising in many ways, but also, I think, a sense of continuity that's highly problematic.
Right, a sense of continuity, Carla Freeman. One thing that is consistent is that there are hardly any women to be found. But let me get your take on the main takeaways from this Congress.
As David said, there are not huge surprises, and the Congress did what it was supposed to do, really. One was, as you mentioned, to extend Xi Jinping's leadership as CCP General Secretary for at least 5 years. He retained his role as Central Military Commission Chairman and is in a position now with this band of loyalists as his Politburo Standing Committee members to really continue to run the show. David also mentioned the list of Politburo Standing Committee members is a group of people with limited experience managing the economy. These are political apparatchiks for the most part who are all deeply loyal to Xi, some with ties to Xi from working together in provincial governments, and also some even with loose ties to Xi's family and his father, Xi Zhongshun. Xi, of course, is the Chinese princeling. But the Party Congress also appointed people to the Central Military Commission. Those names are interesting. If you are looking at the evolution of the Chinese military and what China's military priorities will be, they included people with combat experience, for example, a very old general who had actually fought in China's 1979 war with Vietnam, and others with deep experience on Taiwan. So it looks like the current lineup of the Central Military Commission includes people who are ready in the eventuality of a conflict across the Taiwan Strait. Beyond that, Xi delivered his political report on the CCP's accomplishments and where its emphases would lie in the next 5 years. And as David said, a heavy emphasis on security. And so one of my takeaways is that Xi Jinping is really responding to the international and domestic environment as if China's in a state of emergency. And in some ways, the likelihood that Xi will serve 5, 10, even lifetime as China's leader reflects this sense that China has so many challenges in front of it. It needs a leader who's strong and powerful and can keep the party powerful and in charge. And finally, interestingly, there were a number of amendments to the party constitution. And here's where there might be a little bit of light in the situation, because, for example, the constitution did not remove the phrase, China's in the primary stage of socialism. And if you're a China wonk, you will know that that means that there is some space for market forces.
There may be some space for market forces, but he really, that is, Xi Jinping, doubled down on this state-centered approach, David Shulman. But before we get into that, I wanted to get your take on Xi's hard line vis-a-vis the West and what that signals for China's goals on the world stage.
I think he fundamentally believes, Xi Jinping, that the United States intends to constrain China's rise, has believed that for a long time, even well before we got to the point we are in U.S.-China relations now, where there are arguably things he could very clearly point to that back up that idea. But there's a fundamental belief that the U.S. wants to contain China's rise, to prevent China from rising to become a peer competitor, and that the United States fundamentally wants to overthrow the Chinese Communist Party. And that is the most important factor for Chinese leaders, I think, the sense of party security and the sense that the U.S. is a fundamental, implacable foe when it comes to the party remaining in power and allowing China to achieve the so-called rejuvenation of the Chinese people and become a true great power by 2049. So with that framing, I think for Xi Jinping, there's a sense that the United States is ramping up our efforts to stop China from rising and reaching its full potential. And I think that there's a sense of deep vulnerability that they feel, particularly in the event that there is a crisis and even a war in the Taiwan Strait. I think that Xi Jinping believes that the United States will try to use not just military means, but use economic means, technological means, potentially restrictions on energy to do anything that we can to strangle China in that type of situation. And there's a sense, I think, that you've seen Chinese leaders for a time now saying that there is a decline of the West, a decline of the United States, a fundamental weakness to the U.S. alliance system, which they see as a threat. And I think what they've watched happen as a result of Russia's illegal and unprovoked invasion of Ukraine and the strong allied response to that, particularly in the economic domain, has really gotten Xi Jinping and Chinese leaders' attention. And I think it's raised the specter that if they were to invade Taiwan, that the U.S. might be able to rally a similar response with our allies in the economic space in particular. Now, obviously, China and Russia are very different, and we all recognize that undertaking that kind of effort with our allies would be harder, and the impact would be much, much greater given China's importance to the global economy. But I feel like that's another domain, in addition to the military space, which we're all aware of when we talk about a Taiwan Straits crisis, where China now feels it really needs to double down on self-sufficiency, which is something we also saw in this work report that Xi Jinping gave at the outset of the Party Congress. Self-sufficiency in the economic space, in the technological space, and what that means going forward in terms of this bifurcating technological landscape that we see increasingly between the United States and China. And I think that that's only looking set to continue, which is a worrying trend.
Turning to you, Carla Freeman, David Shulman's portrait of how China sees the United States as this implacable foe strikes me. If that is true, and I'd like to get your take on that, even though certainly there's a lot of anti-China sentiment, but it's not because of anything inherent in China, but China is the one that seems to be aggressive and not following the rules-based order. But what is your sense of that particular perception of China, therefore its policies that flow from it? Because the United States, it seems to me, would see the opposite, seeing a revanchist China cozying up with Russia.
Yeah, it's really an interesting issue. If you just look 10 years ago, the U.S. and China were talking about our bilateral relationship as a very consequential relationship. And that language even continued in the end of the Obama administration. So it's really striking. But the Chinese Communist Party came to power with a mission of restoring Chinese greatness. And I share David's view. They see the United States as an obstacle. Now, the United States for a while was seen as an asset in China's journey. But as the United States pushed back against some of China's trade practices initially, as we have become stronger champion of Taiwan, given the pressure that China has been putting on the island, the United States is seen increasingly as the major challenge for China as it continues to meet its second centenary goal of restoring the greatness of the Chinese people or nation. So from the Chinese point of view, it looks at everything from U.S. export controls to our position on Taiwan and sending our officials to Taiwan, Nancy Pelosi's visit to Taiwan, all as essentially making an effort to discredit China, to undermine its sovereignty. And so in that framework, China has to do everything it can to push back. And you'll see some of China's recent initiatives, such as the Global Security Initiative that has started to get some traction around the world, as a framing which allows China to use language against American hegemony, against NATO. And it's language that sounds remarkably like the language used by Vladimir Putin to justify the invasion of Ukraine. China sees itself as victimized by the United States. This is dangerous because, of course, it means that you have a China that is less pragmatic in its behavior on the world stage and a China much more likely to overreact or misinterpret U.S. actions. And it raises the specter of potential U.S.-China conflict.
We'll have more in just a moment, but first, you are listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. My guests are David Shulman, Senior Director of the Global China Hub at the Atlantic Council, and Carla Freeman, from whom you just heard, a senior expert on China at the U.S. Institute of Peace. We're discussing the implications of China's 20th Party Congress for Beijing's domestic and international policy. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Here's a shout out to a loyal listener and Facebook fan, Matiullah Safi from Kunduz, Afghanistan. If you want to hear your name and home country on the air, please send an email to encounter@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, David Shulman, now with respect to Taiwan, given Beijing's perception of the United States as the aggressor, when in fact it looks like it's the reverse, because Beijing is in fact being much more aggressive, whether it's in the South or East China Seas, with regard to Taiwan, military exercises, and of course, on its home turf in Xinjiang province, the horrific human rights abuses against the Muslim Uyghur population. But regarding Taiwan, Xi got loud applause after he said, "We will never promise to renounce the use of force, and we reserve the option of taking all measures necessary," blaming, of course, outside forces, i.e. the United States and separatists in Taiwan, which he believes are seeking independence. So what should we expect regarding Taiwan, and what should happen to the One China policy, which the United States and China agreed to some 50 years ago? Taiwan is part of China, but that there should be no forceful attack by China on Taiwan.
This is the kind of fundamental question, right, is how do we deal with this problem? How do we support a democratic Taiwan? And how do we do so without inviting a catastrophic war? I think going back to the way you started, Carol, I think it is important to note that in Xi Jinping's work report, there was some strong language on Taiwan. He did reference not renouncing the use of force, but that's not new language. And so there wasn't anything terribly new on Taiwan in this speech. These are phrases that have been used repeatedly before. There's maybe a little bit more focus on opposing foreign interference, which of course is U.S. involvement in the Taiwan Strait issue. But I didn't see anything terribly new in the language that she used at the Congress. And of course, that line about force did get the biggest applause, but that's to be expected, I think. But I think you framed it correctly in the sense that there's a lot of attention paid, and China certainly is trying to shape a narrative around the United States as the actor that is changing the status quo around the Taiwan Strait. But as Secretary Blinken has said recently, and others have said, it's really China that has been changing the status quo over the last several years and really demonstrating much more willingness to use coercive measures, whether it's military, economic, diplomatic, more interference inside Taiwan in its political system in order to push towards, as China would put it, reunification. There's a sense of impatience on the Chinese part in terms of moving ahead. Now, this always leads us to questions around what's the timeline? Do we think that China's going to invade by, you know, all these numbers are being thrown around now, these dates? Is it 2027? The chief of naval operations said at the Atlantic Council just a week or so ago, could be 2023 or 24. I think it's all fairly much of a guessing game. What we do know is that the PLA has been directed to be able to invade by 2027, but that does not mean that China has any intent to do so anytime soon. And I think when we think about this, we need to recognize that even if China has the capacity and the capability to potentially invade, they have a lot of considerations when they're thinking through the repercussions of doing so, not least whether the United States would get involved in such a conflict. And I think they believe that we would at this point. And so the risks for China of invading and compelling by force reunification are very significant to the Chinese Communist Party. And if China were to fail in that endeavor, then that could be the end of the Chinese Communist Party. So it's not simply a calculus of when can we do it, and then when we can do it, we will go ahead and proceed. I think China still does want to avoid conflict. They still would prefer to, quote unquote, peacefully reunify. But that notion of peaceful is not exactly the one that we might use in the sense that, as I said, it involves a lot of efforts to coerce Taiwan toward that direction. And at the moment, it doesn't look like anyone on Taiwan has any interest in being reunified with the People's Republic of China. There's all indication that Taiwan thinks of itself as a separate country. So that is problematic for China. They are watching U.S. actions in this domain. And I think they are trying to do more to push things in the direction that they would prefer. But I think they also recognize that things are not going in the right direction.
Turning to you, Carla Freeman, once again, it appears that the United States is reacting to China's bellicose language and moves vis-a-vis Taiwan, even though Xi Jinping likes to blame the United States and outside actors. But we have seen, as a result of China's moves in the Taiwan Strait, that the United States is coming both rhetorically and in terms of action to Taiwan's defense, so to speak. We saw, as you said, you know, Nancy Pelosi go there and a number of other congressional delegations in recent weeks. But we still maintain this one China policy. But also Biden has been a little bit more overt in saying that the United States would come to Taiwan's defense should it be attacked. What do you make of that language? Is that wise to sort of undermine that more ambiguous policy? What is your take on the question?
That's really interesting, again, because Secretary of State Blinken has also noted a number of times recently that it looks like China has moved up its timeline for reunification in Chinese language of Taiwan. So I think the administration is watching closely and perhaps has information that I don't have. But it seems to me that this is language that the president is using, President Biden is using to deter China and wants to make it very clear that there would be very, very high costs of a military approach to unifying with Taiwan. So my view is that China actually, as David said, has no interest in taking a conventional military approach to unifying with Taiwan. It would much prefer to coerce Taiwan into some kind of agreement. And I think that despite some views that China is, given its faltering economy and many other challenges, view of the United States as hostile, that China is moving more quickly, perhaps to use military force to unify with Taiwan because it feels like time is running out, I actually take the opposite view. I think China still sees the United States as in decline and feels like time is on its side. So if it can wait out a couple of election cycles, sees the United States as tremendously politically divided, which we are, and doesn't have a very positive prognosis for U.S. politics and our political future, I think it believes that time is on its side and eventually Taiwan will come into the fold. The danger is that now there is so much military hardware flying around the Taiwan Strait that there is a real risk of an accidental collision that could escalate. It would be very difficult to prevent that from not escalating into a major conflict. And so we're at a point where after the Pelosi visit, China suspended military crisis communications mechanisms that we'd relied on, the U.S.-China military relations. So we're in a position where we have much more limited options in terms of communicating with our Chinese counterparts in a crisis. And that's something I think that the two sides urgently need to address, because the chances are that a conflict could arise inadvertently rather than having a planned outcome of a decision by Xi Jinping.
Well, thank you for that. I would love to go into so many other aspects of the results of this 20th Party Congress, but perhaps we'll have another program. But before we close, the United States, of course, has consolidated its alliances, the creation of AUKUS, the Quad, in order to combat China and its nefarious activities in the region. At the same time, as you alluded to, Carla, we, that is the United States and China, do need to cooperate, need to talk to avert any kind of accidents, for example, in the Taiwan Strait. But at the same time, we also have to cooperate on climate, on the need to avert pandemics. So let me ask you as we close, David Shulman, with respect to any type of convergence where the United States and China can cooperate, notwithstanding China's doubling down on this communist model, trying to export that very authoritarian model. We have climate, we have the pandemics, we have North Korea. Is there still an opportunity, notwithstanding this hostility, to cooperate on these important issues that pertain to both our nations?
Thank you for that question. I think it's the key one. And I think as relations between the U.S. and China have gotten worse over the last few years, I think the question is, where are the areas where we can still productively cooperate and actually make some headway? And as Carla was mentioning, there is concern about the fact that on some of these critical issues, whether it's military to military talks and crisis communications, on climate talks, on other things that were happening at the working level, those were cut off after Speaker Pelosi's visit by the Chinese. And so the concern is that even those talks, which arguably, especially on the climate side, we don't know whether they were making any significant progress, but it's important to continue to talk on climate. You know, she did say some things indicating that China's going to try to take a leading role at COP27 coming up on climate. We're on the same planet, especially on that climate issue. We do need to continue to be engaging. But if these kinds of talks are going to be sacrificed whenever tensions get hot, as they are seemingly going to continue to do between the U.S. and China, that's problematic. I think we're all looking towards the G20 summit coming up next month, at which we expect that President Biden and Xi Jinping will meet in person for the first time as leaders. They've met long ago in person, and of course, they've had virtual meetings as leaders. But this is a fairly significant moment, and that leader-level channel of communication is even more important than it ever was because of the fact that Xi Jinping is really the only person that matters, number one, in China, sadly, but also because a lot of those working-level engagements are facing difficulties. So the hope is that there can be something positive that comes out of that meeting in terms of restarting some of these engagements where we do need to be communicating, if not cooperating.
And the last word to you, Carla Freeman.
Well, I think the three issues that you highlighted are the ones we really need to focus on. And I think that David's point that maybe at the leader-to-leader level, there'll be an opportunity to open some channels. The Chinese like quiet back channels, and it may be that although they've suspended working-level talks for symbolic reasons, there may be some ways for the two sides to communicate quietly with each other. Our allies would appreciate that. that. They have their own deep relations with China as well as with us. And this is a whole other conversation, but I know that they do not want to be drawn into a conflict that isn't managed to the best of its ability. So I think the G20 will be an important forum for the two leaders to come together and to at least show that they are both committed to a peaceful approach of managing the tensions between the two countries.
Well, on that note, I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this special China edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guests, David Shulman, Senior Director of the Global China Hub at the Atlantic Council, and Carla Freeman, Senior Expert on China at the U.S. Institute of Peace. Encounter was produced in Washington with technical assistance from Rick Pantaleo. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on the Voice of America.